Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 67 for June 8th, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org.
June 6, 2018. After three consecutive weeks of discourse on the subject of clear thinking and communication, some members of the anarchist news community asked, in less polite terms, why there should be a pivot back to fundamentals. Further, you asked if clear thinking and communication were specifically anarchist interests at all, or if perhaps they might be more appropriately referred to as human interest. This is a new segment for the A-News podcast, and since I have an affinity for critics, I've decided to put in the hard work that makes conversation easy. I don't have much time because my not-boss says I need to keep this short, informative, and amusing. So I've decided to cover a topic that deserves a lot of attention by applying as little as possible, and in order to do that, I'll be using a rhetorical tactic that I am critiquing while I'm critiquing it. Everyone knows that anarchists love the smell of the forest and the immensity of the sea. And that's why so few of us live in the city. But who doesn't like blisters on their hands from growing their own food? Or having to travel several hours to the nearest job, just like our commune forefathers and mothers did. I know I sure do. So what's the big difference between being human and being anarchist anyway? Simon Springer, author of The Anarchist Roots of Geography, says during an interview with CrimeThink that, "The point for me is that the term anarchism is just a placeholder for a set of ideas which are subject to experimentation and interpretation based on how different groups are willing to employ them. We need language to communicate ideas, but language also constrains our political imaginations in particular and problematic ways." I couldn't agree more. And that's why it's important to mention that both humans and anarchists can engage in thinking without using internal language to process information. Baby humans, for example, show numerous signs of cognition before they learn language. So what are they thinking about anyway? If I was a baby, I would be thinking about how inhuman our current conditions are, and how prior to civilization, humans and anarchists were really experiencing their golden years. I've studied prehistory using my imagination, and the references to agriculture as the worst mistake in human history, the original affluent society of hunter-gatherers, and man the hunter are immaculate conceptions of what life was like back when anarchists and humans were considered to be one and the same. According to Mark Dibble, the anthropologist who led one such study at the University College of London says, "Studies have shown that in contemporary hunter-gatherer tribes, men and women tend to have equal influence on where their group lives and who they live with. The findings challenge the idea that sexual equality is a recent invention, suggesting that it has been the norm for humans for most of our evolutionary history." He continues, "There is still this wider perception that hunter-gatherers are more macho or male-dominated. We'd argue it was only with the emergence of agriculture, when people could start to accumulate resources, that inequality emerged." What's especially trustworthy about this study is that the tribes being observed are still alive, whereas our prehistoric ancestors are not. But don't worry about how we're overlooking a comparison that's impossible to make. This is science. On top of that, when we talk about talking, it can be a little hard to know what we're talking about, or if we're even talking about the same things. But don't worry about talking like an expert. Here comes Noam Chomsky. One fact about the evolution of language is that it seems to be quite firm that there have been no evolutionary changes for 50,000 years or more. Or, put another way, since our ancestors left Africa. There are no known group differences in the capacity for language or cognitive capacities in general. He continues, Another fact to which we can appeal, in this case with less confidence, is that not long before that, language may not have existed at all. It is, for now, a reasonable surmise that language, more accurately, universal grammar, emerged at some point in a very narrow window of evolutionary time, perhaps in the general neighborhood of 75,000 years ago, and it has not evolved since. In the burgeoning literature on the evolution of language, this surmise, that universal grammar was born intact, is sometimes described as anti-Darwinian, or as rejecting evolutionary theory. But the criticism is based on serious misunderstandings of modern biology. While criticism does exist of the universal grammar model, Chomsky isn't really sweating it. In fact, while it's true that his discontinuity model is less popular among linguists compared to the continuity model, no one is really able to seriously debate him. This can be illustrated by how, in 1866, the Linguistic Society of Paris banned any existing or future debates on the subject of the origins of language. The ban was based on the shortage of empirical evidence, which led many scholars to drop the subject entirely. Meanwhile, in the United States, we're still debating whether or not canola oil is poison, if genetically modified organisms are dangerous, or if vaccines cause autism. However, based on jointly considered genetic, archaeological, paleontological, and other sources of evidence, linguists mostly agree that language probably emerged somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa during the Middle Stone Age, beginning some 280,000 years ago. Which brings us back to our point, the anarchist Garden of Eden, a blissful time when humans were egalitarian hunter-gatherers. One factor which contributed to the utter delight of this period of anarchist human history is that it appears we weren't doing much talking at all, at least with each other. Another theory from St. Chomsky is that the function of language was not originally intended for communication with others. He posits that the mechanism of language was first developed for human anarchists to process more complicated or abstract thoughts using internal language. The words we use in our head when we're thinking really, really hard. According to him, communication with others, or external language, didn't become fashionable until later. As one might expect from anarchist human communication, it seems reasonable to me that at the exact moment when we began to utter our brain words to each other, cognitive bias was born with it. The golden hammer is a cognitive bias that involves an over-reliance on a familiar tool. As the psychologist Abraham Maslow once said, "I suppose it is tempting, if the only tool you have is a hammer, to treat everything as if it were a nail." If Chomsky is right, and internal language begat external language, then around the same time many hippies, punks, New Agers, and primitivists considered humans to be at their peak anarchist, human anarchists proceeded to use a tool which evolved for clear thinking as a tool to call the cops on their neighbors. Anarchists do like hammers, though, especially the communist ones. Moving on. One question I have spent very little time thinking about is if a tool that was designed for, let's say, weighing the pros and cons of proceeding with a certain kind of behavior, then in what ways is that information processed when it is used to shape the behaviors of others? Would our minds process both internal language and external language the same? If so, when an acquaintance once told me that they did not enjoy reading books because they did not like people putting thoughts into their head that were not theirs, I can now pretend to understand what they meant. Some theorists, such as Foucault, wondered if and in what ways our society is being shaped, or constructed by language. As he is regarded as a pioneer on the subject of discourse analysis, it is important to note that he considered that external language reflects the existing power relationships in society, and perhaps even strengthens them. While it is true that some thinking can be done without internal language, there is still a great deal of it that is. On that particular subject, one might say that one cannot think where one has no language. And our internal language is now often informed by external language sources. This means that even human anarchists living in isolation must invest a great deal of time inventing their own language in order to escape the statist in their brain born and maintained by their use of language. So, it seems reasonable to think that regardless of whether you live in a city or in the top of a giant sequoia, learning the mechanics of good conversation is essential for filtering out all of the unhelpful bullshit. For those of you urbanites waxing poetic about your future salvation on a communal farm and how rewilding and unschooling will bestow you with a brand new language, releasing you from your dirty statist thoughts, I'll have you know that while the scripture from AK Press might have you believe that groupthink, or I guess the more politically correct term these days is collectivism, will save you, it will indeed not. Power structures, whether overt or covert, exist everywhere. Whether one is the kind of capitalist who hoards gold coins or the kind that hoards social capital, the efforts by which you achieve either will likely include persuading, convincing, or coercing others. Theodore Zeldin, during his lecture entitled The Art of Conversation, also noted that when you start educating people, you make them critical, and you make them imaginative, and you make them think a little bit for themselves. And the result is that nobody thinks the exact same thing. And the dream of consensus has therefore disappeared. And that means that our institutions can no longer work properly. So what's all this about collectivism anyway? Can we really have consensus if the way we're all consuming external language is context-dependent anyway? Knowing this, can one even wake up a sheeple? If one did, would they wake to a paradigm of their own design or one of yours? How would you know the difference? Measuring the success of one's indoctrination efforts brings us to a classical philosophical question. Is it possible to know anything and to prove it? What is philosophy, though? And prove what to whom? Ourselves or some external? Would the criteria of evidence be different if it were us or an audience? Philosophy, translated from its origins in Greek, means love of wisdom. It is the study of general and fundamental concerns such as existence, knowledge, values, reason, mind, and language. In my opinion, the last of the list is of the most importance since, as I've described, it is used to decide how we'll be talking to ourselves and how we'll share our theories with others. One way people discuss their philosophical theories is with a human anarchist favorite, ethics, or the moral philosophy that involves systematizing, defending, and recommending concepts of right and wrong conduct. I don't know about you, but to me, that seems like some really important shit to talk about, and discourse on that particular subject might be of the greatest motivator for human anarchists to consider the study of clear thinking and the mechanics of conversation valuable investments. Even if the parlor nihilists would have you think otherwise. See what I did there? Probably not. Anyway, of the top three incentives for human anarchists to consider that learning to think and talk writer is important is perhaps our most guilty pleasure, politics, which, in a hilarious turn of events, translates from its original Greek to affairs of the cities. Sorry, tree huggers. Wikipedia, the indisputable source of knowledge, defines politics rather gently as the process of making decisions that apply to all members of a group. Urban Dictionary, perhaps less gently, suggests the etymology of the word politics comes from poly, meaning many, and ticks, a plural that suggests a shit ton of blood-sucking arachnids might jump upon you. It is then defined as the art of looking for trouble, finding it everywhere, diagnosing it incorrectly, and applying the wrong remedies. Perhaps those who are interested in politics should consider practicing a better understanding of the mechanics of conversation so that they might avoid contracting Lyme disease. In closing, whether you're trying really super hard to think for yourself, isolated or social, attempting to judge right from wrong, or participate in decisions that have implications for all the members in your squad, please consider for just a moment how important it is to navigate the beautiful and respectable arts of internal and external language. Not just because you're not an asshole, but because every detail about being a human anarchist fucking depends on it.
Favorite Scientist by Not Mill. Question: how many anarchists does it take to change a light bulb? None, because anarchists don't change anything. If you want to build something, you have to have an accurate understanding of how it works. Okay, maybe you don't have to. Given infinite time, just trying random shit might eventually result in something that works, maybe. But I'd like to propose that understanding how something works can be a more effective method of building things than just trying random shit. Science has arguably resulted in the most effective method of building things that work, perhaps with the exception of nature itself. Where nature built organisms arranged into food chains, scientists built theories of mathematics, models of the universe, and institutions of knowledge. While nature built delicately balanced ecosystems, science built medical devices, telescopes, and industrial machines. And while nature used a process of trying random shit over an infinite period of time, scientists used a process of simplifying things into problems that needed to be solved, clearly, mathematically, and methodically. Here's the thing about science. It has always been deeply subversive. Relying on one's own measurements and reason, questioning and critiquing the authority of experts, these are the hallmarks of science. Paul Feyerabend is an anarchist philosopher of science who recognizes this, and he's misunderstood when he is referred to as science's worst enemy. In contrast to some of the feisty quotes he is best known for, Feyerabend argued that throughout history, science has liberated us from authoritarian narratives of truth, such as religious beliefs. In How to Defend Society Against Science, he argued that even the most radical critics of society believed this. Kropotkin, he argues, wants to overthrow all traditional institutions and forms of belief, with the exception of science. Ibsen criticizes the most intimate ramifications of 19th century bourgeois ideology, but he leaves science untouched. Levi Strauss has made us realize that Western thought is not the lonely peak of human achievement it was once believed to be, but he excludes science from his relativization of ideologies. Marx and Engels were convinced that science would aid the workers in their quest for mental and social liberation. But Feyerabend means something very specific by science in his statement. He is not referring to the monolithic authority on truth with a capital T that anarchists hate. Feyerabend is referring to a method that has been used throughout history to question and challenge authoritarian narratives of truth, by appealing to reason and experience rather than to authority and dogma. Reason and observation are like open source tools that no church or institution can lay claim to. They are free for all to use as they see fit. But Farben recognizes that although science has been an instrument of liberation and enlightenment, it does not follow that science is bound to remain such an instrument. There's nothing inherent in science or in any other ideology that makes it essentially liberating. Ideologies can deteriorate and become stupid religions, he says. Just look at Marxism. So how did science become yet another authoritarian narrative truth, rather than the heretic of ideology, the gadfly of civilized discourse, that annoying guy at a party always asking, "Why should I believe you?" Well, for the same reason that most unchecked ideologies become tyrannical, because it has become populated by ideologues who insist that you trust their authority and word, rather than observing for yourself what is effective and what works. That can happen with any ideology. But effective is important here, because if we simply rely on whatever one person or another says, rather than what our own observations show to be effective, then the loudest, most authoritarian voices will be the ones imposing their truths on others. Feyerabend advocated for science because it is effective at building things that work. And the reason that it is effective is because unlike authority, science thrives from being constantly overthrown. If anarchism is good at anything, it's ensuring that a set of ideas never become an effective method for building things that work. It's hard to think of a better method than anarchism for sowing seeds of discord that may never bloom, for generating a cacophony of disparate, conflicting voices that may never agree, for being the gadfly that always questions the authority of tyrants. Science needs anarchism if it ever hopes to continue being something that works for challenging the authority of tyrants. But anarchism could use a little science if it ever hopes to be effective.
Topic of the week, religion and spirituality. I had a good discussion with friends in Montreal this past weekend about the growth in people approaching anarchy through the lens of spirituality and vice versa. From the burgeoning movement of Christian mystics and radicals through things like the Friendly Fire Collective, which often looks like the religion of struggle, to people engaging with gods and spirits older and younger. The rise in spiritual modes of anarchy is refreshing to me as a phenomenon which offers a challenge to those who love to indulge in the spurious, disagreeable, and pointless exercise of excommunicating the differently faithed among their comrades. This quote is from Peter Lamborn Wilson's essay, Anarchist Religion, which I think offers a decent, if overly optimistic, proposition for rapprochement between the camps of for and against, which basically boils down to the fact that what someone says they believe is less important than how they practice it. That is, that religion can be liberatory and secular beliefs dogmatic, so how much difference is there really? And yet, there are plenty of arguments about matters of the spirit which deserve to be engaged with. What about ideas not having power over us? Is there a logic to the narratives of many faiths, which also underlies many of the dominant social forces we're in opposition to, etc.? How do you feel about spirituality in relation to anarchy? Do you have a concept of the spiritual? Do you practice a religion of some kind? And if so, how does that relate to your politics? Are there spiritual practices which lend themselves more or less well to anarchist practice? And joining me in conversation this week is Wednesday. What are your thoughts about spirituality and anarchism?
Spirituality and anarchism. I've got my own odd, bizarro spirituality that's mostly self-created and within myself, and I don't really... I guess I blend it into some things that I speak about with anarchism in terms of like chaos magic and these sort of concepts.
Oh right, yeah, you give a presentation about this topic, right?
I've given presentations and written about it before, but I think that a lot of how I relate that to anarchism is more trying to give people the tools to develop their own spirituality rather than, it's not so much of
a program
as a, here's a way to explore yourself and develop those things yourself. So I definitely have an appreciation for spirituality and how people practice it. But that's mostly for people who are able to kind of have their own chiseled, spirituality rather than, like, I think I probably respect people more who I, like, know have a quiet spirituality that's maybe complex that they don't need to share with everyone or pronounce as the ultimate form of spirituality.
Why do you think that there's an increasing interest in this topic for anarchists in 2018? Or an increased?
I think that there's probably just so much disillusionment with mainstream culture and outlets and just dead ends in the postmodernity of culture that's and pop culture that's so dull and unfulfilling that people are seeking more outlets like the spiritual sort. So,
and what have you seen from that world that you've been inspired by?
I feel more inspired now to maybe deepen, I work on a lot of art and illustration that have, some spiritual or occult themes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, whereas making these things a few years ago, although a lot of them are definitely popular and iconic, imagery, like now is so much more pervasive that, like, oh, it's like this whole, like, witchy, mm-hmm. queer vibes have become so just mainstream and whatever that now it's like, oh, now it's time to explore deeper and beyond this surface type imagery or ideas.
Yeah, witchy themes feel a little hard for me to map to anarchism.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously, the idea of there being a female spirituality that's, you know, the crone living on the edge of the village. Mm-hmm. I mean, that of course, I get. That makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
But, for instance, I don't feel like I understood... I don't know if you've seen the music video for the Nomadic War Machines.
No.
This is Magpie's project.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically a music video that has a lot of people dressed... witchily,
mm-hmm.
whatever in the fuck that means.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at the end, they basically gear up and do some sort of charge against fascists.
Uh-huh.
So it's a pretty simple, like, moral story in the context of the music video.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it is clear by looking at the actors that it's mostly Magpie's friends.
Uh-huh.
And they are witchy.
Yes.
They're dressed witchily. But I look at it mostly as a sort of generational phenomenon, right? In other words, everyone is very clearly from the age of 25 to 35, mm-hmm. or maybe 40. Mm-hmm. And it looks incredibly countercultural,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like there's no content to it at all.
Yeah. yeah, that's my base impression also, is that it's mostly just a countercultural, aesthetically driven phenomenon that just kind of rides the romanticism of the witch concept, which just kind of seems more like, it seems like an accessible notion because it's almost like the hacker of spirituality, like the witch.
Yeah, oh, that's interesting.
Like,
yeah.
Like the modern, where you can take spirituality and then do whatever your own little
cherry picking
and underground, and then use that against the mainstream, except for that part is where it's hollow, because there's not, like I said, it's mostly just this aesthetic thing, and it's like where it seems like an exciting notion that somewhere there's like actual covens of, and who are like methodically mapping out this interesting altered spiritual world, but and there are certainly people who do like Gnostic Mass and actually are practicing this on a more deep scale, but a lot of those people aren't my age, and you know, it's more middle-aged people who've been into the occult or whatever for a while.
If you were going to say that there were two or three takeaways from your presentation on this topic, what would they be? What would be the two or three useful things? Like you mentioned tools.
I like the concepts of chaos magic a lot.
Chaos magic has a particular history, right? It's not just from like Warhammer.
Oh no, correct. Yeah, like there's a pretty it's a pretty distinct like field or whatever of magic. But
is it Crowley?
No, but it's definitely heavily influenced by Crowley and post Crowley. Yeah, there's a few titles, yeah, it's like a lot of like what I would say is like being able to develop alternate ways of thinking and kind of programming. It's kind of like reprogramming your mind and your connections to the things around you in ways that you're able to abstract and like disassociate from conventional, like,
what's a simple example?
A simple example, so a very root or a very easy practice would be magical masturbation. So like taking like the moment you orgasm or climax is like very kind of mesmerizing and like very kind of subconscious moment, because there's like all these biological and mental and your whole concepts of things that are interesting or beautiful or sexual to you all coming together. So you can do a thing where when you are masturbating or having sex with someone and are climaxing, you can focus all of that moment and come up with something that is important to you that may not be sexual at all, like, I want to work on anarchist podcasts and make that better. And so you can use that moment and then step outside of it with yourself and say, and focus on this thing, or focus on your ambitions, or you can zone out and try to focus on nothing to see what comes into your mind.
So that's the intentional practice. Mm-hmm. And the goal is that eventually when you would orgasm, you would perhaps unconsciously make progress in those directions. Like what's the goal in terms of what you're attempting to perfect or trigger in yourself?
No, like you can still have these unconscious orgasms otherwise, but the goal would be to just to work towards developing a mental framework, or you could call it a spiritual framework, like working towards your own goals and ambitions. And so it's kind of a lot of tools like this, but there's, I mean, and that's a more practical kind of thing. Like a lot of it too could be, you know, like submerging into your subconscious and like dreamscapes and trying to do lucid dreaming, or other forms of meditation and meditative type practices. And just kind of like a lot of them are very rooted in, like Crowleyan type magic or just like, meditative practices and stuff like that. I'm not being very articulate about it right now because I wasn't really,
I mean,
like it's something that I've been a lot more into in the past and like I go in and out of actively pursuing these practices. So,
I think that the person who wrote the topic of the week had the intention not necessarily to just speak of the sort of witchy stuff.
Uh-huh.
They seemed to purposely avoid the topic and the thing,
uh-huh.
or to be evasive about it. They mentioned this group that's more or less driven by, like, Christian principles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious if you've ever run into Christian anarchists and if you've seen, I don't know, growth of that or...
Well, when I lived in the Pacific Northwest a while back, there was definitely an influx of Christian anarchists. And I've never grinded up against any... I've never really had deep discussions with any, so I can't, I don't really understand what their MO is all about. I'm pretty skeptical that Christian anyone could be like sympathetic to me and my pursuits and ideals, but
I mean, it's a strange mishmash that mostly seems to end up being Christian.
Yeah.
And that's what they are.
Yeah, I try to play it out in my mind, like, oh, like, maybe it's like, oh, Christ actually didn't want people to be like this. He was, like, an anarchist and had these cool things. But then it always kind of rolls back into, like, it's kind of like Jews for Jesus or something where, like, it's nefarious in the end. Yeah, yeah. You're like, you're not really Jews for Jesus. You're just Christians.
Well, thank you very much for the conversation, Wednesday.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a wrap. This podcast is the effort of many people. This episode was sound edited by Rosinante Guay, yours truly. What's New by Suds, editorial by Not Null. And thanks to Aragorn and Wednesday for the topic of the week discussion. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. Cheers.
Fall over my heart. I black out the moon. I wait for you to come around. You got me dancing in the dark. I close my eyes, but I won't sleep tonight. Maybe you should come with me. I'll take you to the dark side. Me and you, you and me, do bad things in the night. Everything black.
children of the night. But it's the only way of life. It's black holes pulling me inside of this black heart, the black soul underneath this black.